Good morning. Please be seated. We have to start the session. It's already 11. Then the session this morning is entitled Global Healthcare Perspectives. It's a joint session set up by the IAEA, WHO, and PAHO. And it's a session who has the intention to pave the way towards perspective in health regarding radiation protection. Then we have four speakers this morning. We will ask them to talk for 15 minutes in such a way that we have time for discussion at the end, a global discussion at the end, unless we have burning questions just after each presentation. Then I'm Michel Bourguignon, a commissioner with the French Nuclear Safety Authority, and I chair the session with Professor Michael Kawuya, who is Professor of Radiology of the Ernest Cook Ultrasound Research and Education Center in Uganda. He's also the General Secretary of the African Society of Radiology. Thank you for being with me. Then the first speaker is Professor Nuslin, and the talk is entitled New Radiation Health Technologies, Challenges, Opportunities, and Limitations. And Professor Nuslin is has worked in medical physics for 40 years, mainly in radiation therapy and then in imaging. He was in Tübingen and then moved to Munich, and is currently president of the IOMP and is in collaboration with the IAEA for the development of medical physics in the developing countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm in fact only the reserve. Maria approached me recently to replace Carlos, so I try to do my best. The issue I will shortly review is new radiation health technologies, challenges and opportunities and limitations. The radiation health technologies includes four larger field, there's radiation oncology, nuclear medicine, radiation diagnostics, and medical physics. The radiation oncology includes methods and techniques. The methods is external beam radiotherapy, stereotactic, and so on. And we are using their machine equipment, gamma cobalt machines, particularly Linux, and radioactive sources, afterloading machines, and in the most recent approach, even protons and heavy ions. And on the other side, nuclear medicine as an imaging discipline, like the radiation diagnostic, they are using a lot of modern equipment, and particularly here the PET and SPECT for molecular imaging, and radionuclide therapy, radiopharmacy is an issue, and here is of course the large field of mammography and computer tomography. And the medical physics is something in between. This is a link to the essential sciences, the radiation biology, bioinformatics, and biomedical engineering, and the transform of the science and knowledge there to the three application disciplines of ionizing radiation. The first question arises is, can we wait for a replacement of ionizing radiation? So in the field of imaging, there's ultrasound, but there are limitations from the physics. Particularly, this is limited to soft tissue and this 2D imaging, data fusion. So this is only a very limited field where we can apply ultrasound to replace ionizing radiation. A much larger field is MRI. However, that's challenging in costs and complexity, and very far on the front is needs a lot of research is optical imaging, which may invade the field of classical X-ray based diagnostics. And in cancer therapy itself, the hope is the magic pill, of course, but I can assure you that even the younger scientists in this field don't believe in a successful magic pill, and so we will be limited to efficacy and costs of reasons to stay with radiation therapy. So the radiation therapy team consists of the radiation oncology oncologists and the dosimetrists, medical technicians, nurses, and the medical physicists. And this, in this circle, we are cooperating to ensure safe and effective delivery of radiation to achieve a diagnostic or therapeutic result as prescribed in the patient care, as mentioned in the report of the American Physical Society. So when we are shortly going through the process of the radiotherapy, there are many different phases and steps and areas where medical physicists together with the clinicians and the other staff and stakeholders is involved. Just to mention that market analysis, equipment selection is an important thing, radiation protection, building, and so on, and more going to the patient himself. It is, of course, providing the basic data of the for the treatment planning system, quality assurance, dosimetry, treatment planning, patient immobilization, treatment delivery, plan verification at the end of the successful treatment of a patient, and of course overall the radiation protection of the patient. And this in fact is also directly linked to some aspects of radiation protection outside the treatment room, to, so to say, to workers as well as staff, and finally also public. And this is particularly the interface we see with IRPA. And let me touch another topic, that's cancer. Cancer is something where we are so much dependent on the ionizing radiation. And I show you two slides, one dedicated to the developed countries and the other to the developing countries. There are differences. Oh, there's something lost in the picture. Okay, don't forget that mostly here, according to a survey of cancer treatment in Europe, this means in an industrialized area, about half of all patients, or 70% of all patients, are treated, including radiation therapy. This means partly together with surgery or with chemotherapy, and some particular events also alone. What is coming up at the horizon is more and more combined therapy, radiotherapy, and chemotherapy. The problem and the challenge is this part here of the pie, the local regional tumors, which are not cured due to inappropriate application of radiotherapy. And half of this part here is due to low doses. So this is a really challenge to apply in a proper way, safe and effective. It's not only safeness, safety, what we are dealing with. It's also the effectiveness. Now, the situation in the developing countries, and as an example, I focus here on Africa, which is, from my view, the most important target we have to consider when developing radiotherapy. Look here, according to the WHO review, there are 27 member states which have any access to radiotherapy units. And this is quite a large area of the entire Africa. Don't forget these figures here, that 70% of all cancer patients in low-medium income countries are here in the developing world, and 70% of all cancer deaths are in low, medium income countries. So we are really, even for ethical reasons, challenged to develop ideas, concepts, and actions to deal with that. So one wonderful program has been launched by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the so-called PACT program, and the PACT, under the PACT program there are different initiatives. One is the so-called AGAT group, the advisory group on increasing access to radiotherapy and to define mandatory elements of a radiotherapy package, particularly addressing the problems of developing countries. And this should not only include a treatment unit, which are deployed in a special hospital, but it is much more. The frame for effective support of developing countries should also include the whole machinery we use for radiotherapy, treatment planning, access to imaging, quality assurance instruments, service and maintenance is an enormous problem. The provision with spare parts, and most importantly, education and training. This is really something which has to be linked to the whole package. And another initiative, as I just addressed, is the setup of an education and training system, which we in IOMP have developed some ideas. The requirements are sustainability by continuous repetition of courses, prevention of brain drain by an on-site training, product-specific training by company staff, basic medical physics training according to agreed standards and practicals on-site. And how can we succeed with such a model? The idea was simply to combine a hospital in a developing country, university, and a company reference site to implement their courses, which are repeated every 6 or 9 months, and with the same faculty, at the same location, with the same people. And in order to have the adaption to the international standards, we should use the teaching material, the excellent material which is available from the internet, from the agency, and we should look out for travel grants and for course material. Selection of experts can be solved with the IOMP and according to our framework of accreditation we can help these countries. So the idea is simply to implement a split course consisting of two modules, 1 week for fundamental medical physics and practicing, and another continuing a week with first maintenance on the equipment from that company which is running the machines in that specific reference site. So in between here we can solve the problem of practicals and so on, and when repeating this course every time, every 6 months, I am quite sure we avoid the brain drain and we can ensure some kind of sustainability. So this is just one example, and the key message is that many organizations have to stay together and to work in their various fields, including companies and the WHO, the agency, the IOMP, and of course the IRPA. I thank you very much. I hope I gave you some ideas for the rest of the series. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Then we move to, unless there is a burning question, we move to the second presentation, which is entitled Optimization in Therapeutic Applications, The Challenges, Opportunities and Limitations of New Emerging Radiation Technology by Professor Michael Brada, who is Professor of Clinical Oncology at the University College in London. He has worked his life and has been involved very much in the development and evaluation of technologies and has been the president of many associations and scientific learning societies. Thank you, Professor Brada.
Well, thank you very much. It's a long title. I hope it doesn't take me 20 minutes to pronounce it. I'm just going to give you a broad brushstroke view of the current status of the new things that are happening in radiation oncology. You probably see all these acronyms, and you know, with acronyms there's increasing dollar signs, and then there are lots of names that talk about different machines that supposedly do something different than we used to do before. But actually I think of developments in radiotherapy very simply. Essentially, I'm going to talk about external beam radiotherapy, and external beam radiotherapy still primarily is photon-based radiotherapy from linear accelerators or and the use of cobalt machines. Clearly there are particle therapies that are coming into operation, and I'll just very briefly mention these. Now, in terms of development of technology, they can more or less be classified as refinements in conformality. That means less radiation to normal tissue and more radiation the tumor. And I'm going to talk about conformality in terms of photons and protons. And just an example, this is just an example of lung cancer. And what we are after is an improvement in the therapeutic ratio. So if you have a means of visualizing the tumor better, targeting it better, you reduce the volume of your radiation, and therefore you increase the you reduce the risk of damage from the radiation to the surrounding normal tissue. And that's the principle, and then either it may allow you either to increase the dose to improve tumor control, or it allows you to reduce the toxicity of the treatment at the existing dose. And that's broadly the principle. But of course, there are problems with these approaches. The better you target the tumor, the more likely you are the more you need very precise imaging that tells you exactly where the tumor is. So like in this example, you might treat less, but actually you might be missing some of the tumor. And so it's an enormous reliance on imaging and all the technologies that are associated with this. So the challenges in this are principally defining the target in terms of staging, so you only treat localized disease, not disseminated disease. You can precisely define the tumor margins, and I think this is still an Achilles heel for radiotherapy. And nowadays we realize that things move, people move, organs move, and we need to target, and things change over a period of time, we need to target these. This is just an example. This is a lung cancer. You can see the small dot there, and you can see on the two pictures, actually, it looks quite different. So what should we do? Should we just outline this, or should we outline the on the lung windows? And they're clearly different sizes. And there is a suggestion that it is the lung windows that are more important. Okay, so it's fine. You've got some piece of information that tells you that it's better to define the target on the lung window. But if you actually start looking at it in detail, I would challenge anybody to tell me exactly where the tumor finishes when you've got this kind of star appearance. And I think radiotherapy pretends to know, but actually more or less we failed in telling exactly where it is. Certainly in lung cancer, it's fine in benign tumors and it's fine in some other tumors, but this is a particular challenge. So we might be able to target it well, but we don't always know precisely where to give it. And one example, again, is here, PET scanning. So you can think that all of this is tumor, but then you have a PET scan that shows you that the bit beyond here is actually collapse. And the challenge is that we're not absolutely sure there are no tumor cells in this. So we rely increasingly on modern imaging, but perhaps the risk is that we may rely on it too much. So that's photons, so we shape the beams with shaping devices, with collimators, so we can use so-called intensity modulation, so IMRT, intensity modulated radiotherapy. But all intensity modulation does is allows the treatment of more complex shapes to a homogeneous dose. It's not, you mustn't think of it as some wonderful new treatment. It's the same treatment with better conformality of complex shapes, and it allows you to give differential doses to different bits of the tumor. The advantage of protons is shown here. Now, this is the physics. This is the physics impression of protons. Sometimes I call it the Walt Disney impression of radiotherapy, because this is not real. You know, you have a Bragg peak for protons, and you have the gradual fall of photons. This is the photon line, the proton line. But of course, this is not how we treat patients. This is how you sell proton machines. We have to, because the tumors are finite of a particular size, you have to modulate the protons, and if you summate them, you get something, you have to get a spread out of a Bragg peak, so it doesn't quite look as neat as the individual point, other than, of course, you get a reduction of those beyond it. And of course, we don't treat with a single beam of radiation, it's also no reality. The reality is we treat with multiple beams, and the differences in terms of dose distribution become much less distinct than you think by looking at Bragg peak. Yes, there is more dose at the exit of the beam, but there is actually more dose from protons at the entry of the beam. So the difference is not as great as you would imagine when you're looking at the single beam. But clearly there is some dosimetric advantage. Now, when you have a very precise delivery of protons, you do have a problem because the precision, again, leads to potential risk. So this is an example of a proton beam that's hitting the side of the pelvic wall. And because it's such a defined position of the beam, if there is any change in the patient's shape or size, like here, you end up with a completely different position. So the risks of this technology is that, again, it requires much more detailed information of the patient's status, and a much more detailed imaging. So there are some advantages to the technologies, there are some considerable disadvantages, and clearly an enormous complexity. Again, imaging is extremely important, and the change over time is extremely important. Now, we've come to realize that there is an importance of time factor in radiotherapy. In the old days, we used to start treatment, you know, 6 weeks fractionated radiotherapy, took some pictures, and they looked fine, and then you just carry on for 6 weeks the same. But of course, things change over both within each of the treatment, because the treatment itself has been at a defined time, say a minute or 2 minutes, something probably changes there. And then, so it's an intra-fraction change, and things change over the period of time. Tumors may get smaller, may get bigger, normal tissues get affected, and that needs to be taken into account. So I'll just give you an example here. This is lung cancer, and clearly the tumor is moving, and we can measure this. Nowadays we can do four-dimensional CT scans, which actually tell you the whole excursion of the motion of the tumor. And so that needs to be taken into account. So how do we deal with it? There are increasing technologies that can deal with it, and you can deal with it purely in a technological way, and I've just shown it here how you can do it. Normally, what we do is the standard fixed delivery. There is a tumor. You more or less know what its trajectory is, so you do a margin to account for the trajectory, and then you treat the whole excursion of the tumor. We can gate stop it from moving, or you can actually track. So, you know, we can do it with missiles, so why can't we do it with radiation? You know, if there's a heated object and we've got some marker in it, you can actually follow it. That's, you know, the ideal is the patient walks around the treatment room and the beam just follows them exactly, which is, I'm sure that's what physicists would like. So you can certainly do real-time tracking, but that means real-time imaging information of the position of the tumor. And it's technologically quite challenging, but it's technically possible, and certainly you can shape the beam, for example, with multi-leaf collimators, and there are now miniaturized linear accelerators which are mounted on robotic arms, and the arms that can move in some sort of predicted fashion. There is a disadvantage, of course, if you miniaturize a LINAC, you have a less dose rate and you have a smaller beam, so actually it becomes much more complex in other ways other than tracking it. But of course we can make the patient do things. So what we normally do is that they have normal unregulated breathing, we can regularize it, which is quite difficult, or you can have breath holds, actually we can anesthetize the patient and then we can actually control the motion. And we can probably combine the two. So this is what we normally do, which is the two extremes, probably the least technologically challenging aspect. And this is the breathing phase where you have differences in amplitude and frequency of the breath, of the breathing, which is normal in all of us. As you know, take a deep breath sometimes, and so it's not regular. So what you can do is some kind of gated technique, and the two methods of gating is that you give it in a particular phase of respiration, which is quite complicated because, and so you... And I won't go into the details. The simplest way is actually have an imposed breath hold, which is very defined volume. And actually, this is a technique that's of some interest, and probably this is the least technologically demanding, but takes the involvement of the patient in this. Now, this is how we deal with intra-fraction motion, and we need to deal with inter-fraction motion. So at the bottom here is a six-week course of radiotherapy, and during the course of radiotherapy, that may be some collapsed lung, and the actual lung opens out, and the tumor moves. So we do need to know precisely where the tumor is. And here is an example of combination of cone beam CT. So as you know, we can take CT pictures during radiotherapy on a mounted X-ray source that's mounted on the gantry that takes pictures, and you can then see, for example, here that the tumor is in a different position in the cone beam CT compared to the planning CT scan, and here, so you need to make some adjustments. You can use this technology for what's called adaptive radiotherapy. So the theory is like this: you have this tumor, this of this size, prior to start of treatment, and then halfway through the treatment, the tumor gets smaller here, and you'd reduce the volume, and later on, you can do it again, and you can do theoretical calculations how you can increase the dose and therefore improve tumor control. Lots of theory in this. There are, of course, challenges, because you treat like this, but of course, again, you assume that there is no tumor. You know, you completely rely on imaging as telling you where the tumor cells are, which is not always entirely reliable. So these are things that, you know, some people claim you should be doing it because it looks wonderful. There are some of us who are slightly more sort of academically minded and say that perhaps it should be tested as a theory and see whether you actually improve the results in patients. So this is conformality, time factor, and ultimately IGRT, this image-guided radiotherapy, is essentially as a quality assurance program where we take pictures, and it's assumed to be the verification of the treatment process during therapy here, but actually it depends on all the other imaging. And you can take pictures right at the beginning, so you do statistical function and say, the five images give you some information about systematic error, and then you apply it, or you can do it weekly, or you can do it daily. And I'm not going to go over this data because we don't have much time, but essentially, the more frequently you do it, the more precise it is, but then you have a problem that you are using more radiation for imaging in addition to the plant treatment. The doses are relatively low. They're not the same dose as standard CT because it's a single CT arc. And with all these technologies, there are real issues because suddenly you are now relying on imaging during treatment, and you're often relying now on the radiation technologists to make decisions. And you're relying on the patient's positioning, so you rely on new technologies. And I have seen this in practice that, you know, the technologies decide on changes that may not be true representation of what happens, and it's greater reliance on the imaging, which may not tell you what you think it tells you. So there is a real need to design proper protocols and train the staff beyond to what they've been trained before. So imaging is extremely important. And not only imaging, you need to do competency tests throughout the training as staff change. So there are considerable risks using this technology of image guidance, which should be quality assurance, but it's quality assurance by people. There are technical ways of co-registering the patient data from the beginning to the time of treatment. This is not precise and it's open to a lot of errors, and there needs to be considerable staff interpretation of this. And again, I have seen that this can not only improve situation, but actually can lead considerable risks unless it is properly regulated. So this is essentially the development of technical radiotherapy. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when you introduce new technology into practice, it should be based on clinical need. You know, what is the disease with worst outcome, and how can we improve the treatment, and can we show that the new treatment actually will deal with the outcome measure that we're interested in. But of course, we live in the real world. There are companies that make new bits of kit that believe going to be useful, and a lot of the developments are driven by technology and commerce, and we need to distinguish the two. But as a clinician and academic, you have to set the rules. You know, what technology should we introduce? Well, there are technologies that improve the radiotherapy process. You know, there are, say, IT equipment that connects all the machines that speak to each other and so on. It's extremely important. It doesn't necessarily improve clinical outcome, but there should be, those that deal with specific treatment should have a clinical benefit. So I ask a very simple question when, this doesn't require great academics for this. What would you like the new technology to do, would like it to achieve? And then you say, well, not in abstract, what do you like to achieve if it's a friend or family need radiotherapy? And it's kind of boils it down to something very clear. What you want is, and of course they have to pay, because when you say, well, it's state-based, I want state-based, actually we pay the state, so it's from our taxes, so it's not somebody else's money. So we want the patient to live longer with fewer side effects. So if it's our family, and they want to have easier treatment perhaps for the same good outcome. So very straightforward measures. So the measures that the radiotherapists use are improved tumor control and reduced toxicity, but these are very much surrogate endpoints. And I want to show it to you on an example. So here, for this is the use of IMRT in head and neck cancer, which is quite, it's taken off and it's very important, because here you've got a parotid gland, and if you treat head and neck cancer here, you can avoid treating one of the parotid glands or both using the IMRT technique, and therefore improve salivary function. But of course, you do compromise here on the dose of the target, and we need to show that we're not looking at one parameter, we're looking at parameters both in terms of tumor control and and function. Now, really the most important endpoints are survival and quality of life, which is very difficult to measure. And again, I want to show it to you an example here. There's a thing called radiosurgery. You know, wonderful new treatment is just very highly targeted radiation, which is not, it's been around for 25 years, it's not new. And you can treat brain metastases with it. And this is a curve of, this is a big randomized trial giving radiosurgery, but you can see that the survival of patients hasn't changed at all. It's made no difference overall. This is 1, 2, or 3 brain metastases, it doesn't really matter. But people say that it's an extremely good treatment, because at 1 year, you've got improvement in disease control. It's 90% compared to, say, 70%, okay? 20% improvement in disease control. Now, if you look at it, it looks very appealing, but it's complete nonsense. Because, first of all, it's not statistically sound, because here, it's only 20% of the patients that are alive. So it's tumor control in such a small population of patients, although the actual numbers of patients that benefit from it are so small. And who cares? The patient probably doesn't care, because they have lots of other problems, and they don't necessarily die of brain metastases. So looking at tumor control in isolation is a very poor surrogate, especially in diseases which have a poor outcome. And the example of it is also here, misusing stereotactic body radiotherapy. Now it's called SABR, wonderful new treatment in radiotherapy. It's all it is. It's a more highly focused radiation. It's given in smaller fractions rather than bigger fractions. So we can do it easily because, we have the technology for visualizing, and we can do multiple beams. It's not, it's not a great departure in terms of radiotherapy. But again, people focus on tumor control here, which is kind of 90%, but actually half the patients are dead. And there is currently no evidence that it necessarily prolongs survival. So we need to talk real money. So we are in a real world where the technology and commerce drive often things, and it's sometimes very difficult to distinguish whether it's the driving force is the technology or it is a clinical need. And I think you just need to be awake to see which one it is. And I think we need to actually boil it down to the proper endpoints that we want to see. So when you have advertising that says, you know, treatment is more precise, more focused, it's image-guided, intensity modulated, it can bamboozle patients because it's direct-to-patient marketing, but these are not endpoints we're interested in. Our treatment has always been precise, and there is a limitation of imaging in terms of precision, there is a limitation of patient movement and so on, but they are not necessarily important to the outcome. So we need to demand outcome data in all this. And I'm going to skip this because I'm running out of time, but essentially, if you don't have clinical data, there are certain steps you should look through. You should show that there is a benefit of the technology in a clinical setting that you can measure, and I'm not going to go over it, but you should then demand a clinical evidence of benefit using the standard used phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 study design. And I just want to, let me just skip over this. I just want to remind you, those of you that are involved in clinical studies, that, you know, somebody says, well, I've treated 100 patients, or, you know, these new technologies come online, they say 35,000 patients have been treated with this condition, okay? And then they report on a paper that's treated 20 or 30 patients, and they say the results are better than something else. So this is what is called a phase 2 study, and phase 2 study provides absolutely no information about comparative efficacy because the results are entirely dependent on selection of patients, and they are much more the drivers of the outcome than the actual technology used. And why this is still used in all the machines that are being sold to you, you know, whether it's protons, whether it's, you know, all these knives and whatever technology is, I don't understand it. It is just not true. But it appeals to the need of patients who, you know, have desperate diseases and they like to believe it. But I think academically it should not be. It should not be allowed. It should really be a proper comparative studies. And I just let me just show you just an example, not on radiation, but this is just how industry behaves. This is some electrical fields, tumor-treating fields. It's a company that makes this piece of kit, which puts a kind of electrical helmet on the head and provides electrical fields. And there are some reasonable laboratory data from in vivo, in vitro, that it may do something to tumors. Okay, so equivalent to a kind of a phase, you know, study of a new drug. So it's been tested in people. And you have this battery pack and the machine that you carry around with you, and you have this thing on for 20 hours a day, you know, more or less sleep with it. And they were a sensible company, and they organized the trial, which is a randomized trial of this new treatment versus any choice of chemotherapy. And this is in recurrent disease. In malignant brain tumors, and the result is very clear. There is no difference. You can say that both treatments are equally effective. I'm afraid I have a slightly more acid view. I think they're both equally ineffective in this particular situation. I think that's what the conclusion is always when you have two, you know, trial of two agents that have the same outcome. It's a miserable situation having a recurrent glioblastoma. But then they do something tricky, which is called, so this is by intent to treat. They take the data and separate it by those patients actually who received the treatment, okay? Treatment per protocol. Now, those of you that are involved in statistics and trials know that it's a complete no-no. You're not allowed to do it. And this is an example. So here, you're not allowed to do it because what happens to actually have the machine set up will probably take about a month to get it organized, get your head shaved and all this thing stuck on. So those patients that actually die before have the treatment, you know, that's the flat bit of the curve here. And then the curves go exactly the same. So what they've done is they selected out the bad patients. The bad patients had chemotherapy here because they could get it straight away. And on the basis of this information, which is a randomized trial, has been presented at a prestigious meeting, they say that is a new treatment, successful phase 3 trial. And so we don't only have to battle with phase 2 studies that are useless, but even phase 3 studies that are completely twisted by industry for their own purposes. So this is not radiation, but this is equivalent. And this last example is this is an acoustic neuroma, so some of you have So this is an acoustic neuroma, benign tumor, doesn't kill people, but it's people lose hearing and there are some small risks with it. So it's treated, and it can be treated in fractionated radiation, either kind of 4-week course, 5-week course here, 5 to 6 week course, or you can treat it with single fraction, so it's radiosurgery and fractionated stereotactic radiotherapy. Or you can treat it with hypofractionated treatment. And this is what I used to do, and the results are extremely good in terms of tumor control. You don't measure survival because people live, that their lifespan is not affected by the treatment. And you can see there is a 90% control at 10 years, roughly, over 90% control. And then somebody comes along and says, I have a machine that can only give treatment in fewer fractions. Now, isn't it great? It's convenient to do it. So first of all, you know, you have people tried it with conventional treatment, they say, well, save electricity, you know, save the traveling, it's very good. And they produce the results, and these are the results from Johns Hopkins. And you can see at 10 years, which is here, the control rate is nearly zero. So as far as I'm concerned, it is a useless and potentially dangerous treatment. And you've only changed fractionation. Yet there are machines out there that are being sold to you because they, but they have limitations because of the dose rate or whatever they do. They say it's very precise, but because the dose rate can only be given in fractions, small fractions, but it is publicized as treatment for acoustic neuroma and other benign tumors. So this is just an example that, that you need to be very careful. And I think I'm going to stop here. So there are interesting developments in radiotherapy. They're all about improving therapeutic ratio, and some of them, they are increasing complexity, they are potentially of great advantage, and certainly protons are potentially of value, but they are all complex systems that rely on many steps, and as complex systems, they can lead to systems errors. There is increased demand on limited resources, so if you want high-tech, you then may have to neglect something else, so there is a real problem in terms of running these in a department. They very much rely on in-image interpretation, which is not always, not every radiation oncologist can do it, so that's a new, there's a skill that really needs to be developed. And relies on the and the clinical expertise in this situation is sometimes more important than the technical prowess to be able to show this to use the technology. And we have to recognize that sometimes these machines are sold on some commercial basis, that on a lease arrangement, and you can't really discover the real data in terms of outcome because there is a demand to be using these machines very frequently, and they do bring sort of unfair pressure on the measure of outcome of and effectiveness of these treatments. So this is, I think there is a need for, there's still a need for randomized studies even with technology in which are very good, very difficult to come by. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Then we move forward, and we have all the questions at the end. The next presentation is entitled Challenges, Opportunities, and Limitations to Improve Justification of Medical Imaging. And the presentation is made by Professor Lawrence Lowe, who is a radiologist from Melbourne, is the past president of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Radiologists, and the founding chair of the International Radiology Quality Network. Lawrence?
Thanks very much, Chair. Thank you very much for the organizers for your invitation. Good morning, delegates. The topic today is on the challenges, opportunities, and limitations to improve justification of medical imaging. I shall start with the definition of quality and explain how justification contributes to patient care, then outline the challenges, limitations, and possible future solutions to improve justification at healthcare system and end user level. And finally, outline the case for an inclusive platform to advocate justification in the next decade. Quality can be characterized in many different ways for different settings and perspectives. These elements underpin patient-centered care and good medicine. Quality medical imaging may be summarized as a timely access to and delivery of integrated and appropriate procedures in a safe and responsive facility, and a prompt delivery of accurately interpreted results by capable personnel in an efficient effective, and sustainable manner. Radiation safety, in that case, is one of these quality elements. Under this framework, procedure justification, improve safety, appropriateness, efficiency, effectiveness, and sustainability. The common objectives for the stakeholders in medicine and in healthcare is for better quality, safety, and patient-centered care. To improve patient safety and care by more appropriate use of radiation medicine procedures could be achieved by the use of referral guidelines as a justification tool. Justification of radiological procedures is applied at three levels. Evidence-based referral guidelines are useful tools for individual justification. In this presentation, I shall outline the challenges, limitations, and opportunities to improve justification at both healthcare system and end-user levels. The key challenge is an increasing demand due to aging population and technological advances. When medical imaging procedures are inappropriate use as a result of misuse, overuse, or underuse, will lead to suboptimal care, waste of resources, and increase in population exposure. The limitation for healthcare systems include limited resources, low general awareness, and limited guidance. Further, the independent undertaking of related actions could limit possible synergy and impact. For the end users, possible limitations include the end users not recognizing the difference between the tertiary and community practices, not keeping up with the knowledge and current practice trend, not evaluating the patient adequately or providing sufficient or clear data in the referral, or by requesting a procedure which will not change patient management, or unaware of procedure justification principle and the use in practice, self-referral, and finally, undue medical legal concerns. There is already a large range of actions addressing the varying needs for healthcare systems and end users to improve the justification of medical imaging. For example, there are referral guidelines related projects in the development, pilot and implementation, and evaluation of their use. In this talk, focusing on the future, the intent is not to go over the existing or specific justification project, but rather to provide you with an overview of the approaches which we could take to improve justification in the next decade. Improved use of justification could be considered in a framework of radiation protection measures, implementation strategies, and process improvements, which altogether underpin a range of justification actions. Firstly, the radiation protection measures. The three measures along the patient journey are procedure justification, optimizing of image quality, diagnostic information, and radiation protection, and finally, error reduction. Justification, located at the beginning of this journey, serves a very important gatekeeper. Optimization and error reduction actions reduce exposure and thus can influence justification in certain situations. Among all these implementation strategies, providing education and training is the most common and perhaps most tangible approach. But the other strategies are just as important. When working on justification actions based on these implementation strategies, the key is to translate the evidence into knowledge and then apply this into practice. Future actions could be improved based on the lessons learned from the outcomes of the pilot and implementation. Here come the process improvements. These 10 processes are listed here. The combination of the 3 measures, 7 strategies, and 10 processes underpin the development, implementation, evaluation, and enhancement of many related actions, leading to an overall improvement of justification in practice. Well, the opportunities. From an end-user perspective, using this framework, the possible actions to assist the referrer could include actions to improve awareness of justification principles, referrers' roles and responsibilities, the use of guidelines and checklists. For the providers, this could include actions to lead and build teams, improve efficacy, collaborate and guide referrers, the use of implementation tools, and conduct audits, check the outcome and improve methodology. The Royal College of Radiologists referral guideline publication is one of the best available. Based on this publication, some of the questions a referrer could use before requesting a procedure are given here. For example, has this procedure been done already? Will the procedure and the result change patient care? Is this the optimal time? Is this the most appropriate procedure? Have I included all the relevant data and reasons? And are all these things necessary? Well, for the healthcare systems, to strengthen the existing and the planned future actions to improve justification of medical imaging in healthcare systems require the strong efficacy by professional organizations and agencies, the adoption of policy by the local authorities, and end-user uptake. Therefore, the support and involvement of many stakeholders with different expertise and means are needed. There is an increasing use of radiological procedures in recent years. To address the stakeholders' concerns and to improve the implementation of justification in medical imaging globally in the next decade, in different settings require many different actions. These actions are simply beyond the expertise or the resources for an individual organization, agency, or authority. Therefore, a collaborative framework to facilitate and coordinate this action is desirable. This framework could leverage on collective resources and experience, could be part of an existing initiative or a new framework, and the scope will cover the development, trial, implementation, evaluation, and ongoing improvement. The Congress program is based around the 4 pillars of radiation protection. Applying this framework to this discussion, the elements are shown in the next slide. Scientific evidence underpins radiation protection principles and the recommendations in referral guidelines. The use of referral guidelines in practice is encouraged. Utilization assessment provide ongoing feedback to complete the quality loop, which is most invaluable to optimize to future, improve future development. The inclusive multi-sectorial global platform previously mentioned can serve as the nucleus to facilitate future actions, to strengthen stakeholder communication and collaboration, to promote leadership and team building, to minimize undertaking actions in isolation, to identify synergies and promote cross-fertilization, to be the registry for referral guidelines-related projects, to identify the gaps and proactively design future actions, advocate and raise awareness as a coordinated group, and to mobilize share, and maximize resources. Further, to facilitate policy adoption and infrastructure strengthening, to explore social entrepreneurship, to streamline development and update of evidence-based guidelines, to collate, develop, and improve access to guidelines, trial and implement guidelines, to evaluate the use of guidelines in practice, to facilitate innovations towards better end-user participation, and to reward excellence. Well, the possible barriers against the formation and the maintenance of such a platform could include different philosophy and stakeholder participation, limited resources for individuals, organizations, and systems, the turnover of key personnel and leadership, program action and coordination, lead time for action completion, and finally, the development of an optimal model and supporting infrastructure to bridge the gap between evidence and practice. However, these potential challenges could be tackled because the stakeholders share common long-term vision and similar value. The stakeholders will collaborate and work together as teams to share corporate memory and to apply an inclusive framework and an innovative and proactive work plan. So to conclude, medical imaging is indispensable in modern medicine, patient care, and save lives. Procedure justification improves the use of medical imaging and radiation medicine, quality care, and patient safety. The past efforts have laid excellent foundation to future actions based on 3 radiation protection measures, 7 implementation strategies, and 10 improvement processes. A multi-sectorial global platform could perhaps be used as a nucleus for stakeholder collaboration in coordinated actions to improve justification in the next decade. The International Radiology Quality Network looks forward to collaborating with your organizations and other stakeholders to advance to participate in the actions to improve justification of medical imaging in the next decade. Thank you again for the organizers for your invitation and to all of you for your attention.
Thank you, Lawrence. Then we move to the last presentation, which is entitled Promoting Improving Safety Culture in the Medical Sector. And the presentation is made by Steve Ebden-Jackson, who is currently the head of the Medical Exposure Department at HPA Agency in the UK. And prior to that, he was working as a hospital physicist and also as a regulator in the Department of Health in England. He's a member of the Article 31 Euratom Group and is also a member of the medical applications of IRCA. Steve?
Thank you very much, Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the invitation to be here. The talk is about safety culture rather than safety per se. And of course, there'll be other talks in the conference about safety culture. And I hope those people who are speaking will have the same difficulties that I had. It's quite difficult to put your finger on a good safety culture. It's one of those things that perhaps we think we've all got until something goes wrong. And perhaps that's the key. We should start by looking at something where something's gone wrong and learn from somebody else's mistakes. Now, for those of you who are not from the UK or Ireland or perhaps the USA, you might not recognise this image, but it's been everywhere for the last couple of months in the UK, certainly. And this is a luxury liner called the Titanic, which was launched 100 years ago in 1912. It sank about 4 or 5 days later when it hit an iceberg. Now, this was the epitome of technological advancement at the time. This was a 52,000-ton boat, which was 900 feet long and had a top speed of 24 knots. It was pride and joy. And there was a phrase that was attached to the Titanic, and the Titanic was unsinkable. The problem with the Titanic was it epitomises all those things that go wrong when there's no real safety culture. There was no real organisation around evacuation techniques. There were only lifeboats for 60% of the crew and passengers. And nobody had actually ever bothered to launch the lifeboats with people on them. So in fact, when the disaster happened, a large number of the lifeboats went down with only half the people in them. There were issues about the design, some compromises. Well, that's fair enough, perhaps. That's commerce. But there were also issues about the way the processes of safety were thought about. There are stories that the lookout point had no binoculars so that they couldn't see the iceberg till it was a bit late. Now, the consequence of all this was that out of about 2,225 passengers and crew, 1,500 people, or in excess of 1,500 people, died. I think we'd all recognise this as a situation where there wasn't a safety culture. We didn't have any sense around that time of the key components, and there was a massive misperception of what was going on in that system. And that wasn't unusual 100 years ago, and for the next 20 or so years after this event, although small things were made better in certain industries, we still had plenty of industries where things had an acceptable level of disaster associated with them, and some still exist. But at least by the 30s, we were starting to analyse some of the issues around safety and around safety culture and around accidents. And we all know this triangle, and we've all used it, and I won't go into it in any detail. We think we know what we're doing in medicine, and of course safety culture is absolutely paramount in medicine. This is a phrase that's often attributed to Hippocrates, but it's not actually in there, but it's pretty damn close. The first do no harm seems to be a pretty good idea and encompassment of safety culture. Well, in our own field, in radiation medicine, we didn't do particularly well to start with. And this particular monument, again, something that will be familiar to most of you, is that in Hamburg that commemorates the 169 physicians and technicians who died from radiation-induced diseases up in the first section of the use of ionising radiation in medicine. So again, safety culture didn't really exist. I think a lot of these people who died knew exactly what was going to happen to them. And it might be laudable that they carried on and did what they did. What's not acceptable and laudable is that the organisations and systems that they worked in allowed it to happen. There was no real safety culture. Over the next 50 years, things improved. We had, certainly in the UK, things like Factory Acts and Health and Safety, etc. Acts, which tried to address safety, if not the concept of safety culture, in the totality. But we were at least heading in the right direction. But we all sat up in 1988 when the Chernobyl disaster occurred. And again, this is a situation where the safety culture was awry. Perhaps more important for my purposes today, this is around the time when the term safety culture started to be used and started to be used regularly. And this definition here from the International Nuclear Safety Group in 1988 wasn't bad. The assembly of characteristics and attitudes in organisation, etc., etc. This was the first real definition of what safety culture was and meant. And in the next few years, other organisations followed suit and added to the debate. The Health and Safety Commission in the UK talked about values and attitudes and perceptions, and I think that's very much part of a cultural thing. And the Advisory Committee on the Safety of Nuclear Installations made the very important point that there has to be confidence in the efficacy of preventative measures, or you're really almost wasting your time. Now, 1988 was significant, certainly in the UK, from a medical radiation point of view, because we had one of our well-publicised problems in radiotherapy and an accident involving about 200 people, where a device was incorrectly calibrated because one person was working on their own, the equipment that they were using was inappropriate, and there was inappropriate pressure to bring that equipment back into clinical use. So we still had our safety culture problems in radiotherapy, and we all know radiotherapy, with its complexities, is prime as an area where we can have problems. We know what those problems can be, and we accept that, we know that, and we've worked towards it. We've worked towards radiotherapy safety for many, many years. But again, whether we were working properly towards a safety culture is debatable, because largely the initiatives were by professional groups or individuals alone, rather than encompassing all the elements that were needed. And of course, probably in the 80s still, we had this perception in medicine that radiation safety and safety problems and certainly deterministic issues were only a radiotherapy problem. We've seen those. They certainly didn't exist in diagnostics. Of course, CT and interventional radiology are complex processes. And so we start to wake up to the idea that, well, there is the potential in interventional radiology to do some pretty horrendous things too. And we've all seen these slides before, and I'd like to thank Alessio Vagno, I think, for the first one on the top left. But CT, that's a different level, isn't it? CT has not got the same potential, and it won't happen there. Well, here we go. The New York Times tells us about these problems with CT and perfusion protocols where things have gone wrong and we've had problems. And apart from the evidence, we know the media is telling us all about it. These are just clips from the USA and the UK. I'm sure I could have found them in any country in the world. So we've got to a point where we have to acknowledge we need a safety culture. We need that culture as well as specifically focusing on safety. And we need to build on the work that was done 70 or 80 years ago from an academic point of view and look at how we can build a safety culture and build the components of a safety culture. And again, Reason's Swiss cheese model is familiar to us all, and it's a nice depiction of the issues that are around how things happen, how things can escape our attentions, even though we've got defensive mechanisms in place. My own view is that one of the biggest things that we should address are the interactions between and the interfaces between professional groups and professional activities. Things fall between cracks as well as falling through holes. You can represent the influences of accidents and so on by identifying organisational and strategic factors and local and environment factors and human errors. You can depict these things in lots of different ways. The bottom line is that we are now starting to understand that we need to have a safety culture, and we're starting to understand some of the things that we need to be in place to stop some of the most extreme incidents happening, or at least reduce their probability. So how do we actually do something about this? How do we generate and support and enable a safety culture to happen? Well, I think you have to hit safety culture at every level. We've talked about in the past, radiation safety was very much something that came through perhaps professional bodies or through individuals. But you have to start at the top. There have to be statements in directives. The concept has to be allowable within regulation. Professional guidance is still critical. And on a local level, we need to have practical approaches to what we're doing. The IAEA, in its interim statement on the basic safety standard in 2011, has quoted this as its definition for safety culture. And it isn't very much different to the one that I showed you earlier on from 1988, which was just specific to the nuclear industry. It's changed just a few words. But hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So we have a good definition, and we have a good idea from the BSS where we should go and why we need lots and lots of people involved in this at every level. And these are the key components that are in the IAEA Basic Safety Standard about producing a safety culture. Commitment, individual and collective commitment. It's no good this being owned by one group. It's got to be owned by all. There needs to be a common understanding of the key aspects of the process that you're working with and how that interacts with safety and within a safety culture. Support needs to come from the organisation, because without the organisation providing that support, you cannot expect participation of individual workers. They will not work in a safety culture environment if something's not being provided for them. We talk a lot about no blame cultures when we talk about the safety issues and safety cultures, because with a no blame culture, you're more likely to find out what's going on. I don't think we should confuse no blame with no accountability. I think accountability is key. We need open communication. We need a questioning and learning attitude so that people challenge, not only within their own professional group, but with other professional groups, so that we can move forward together. And we need to remove any level of complacency. It's been my professional role in the past to investigate incidents that have happened in the UK. And every time you walk in and the first reaction that you get is, well, we didn't think it could happen here. That's got to be taken out at the beginning. So certainly at the directive level, we have this from the IA to work with. Within UK regulations, we've sort of approached this by saying we need to identify duty holders, the employer, to provide a framework, professionals that work within that framework. But within the law, they have an equal legal responsibility. They're all in there, and you need everybody, and we need to acknowledge that everyone has a role. And we've tried to do that within our regulations. And we've tried to do it in terms of local guidance, whether it's general guidance or whether it's sector-specific. 2009, ironically, the Department of Health talked about an organisation with a memory. And those from the UK will smile at the idea of the Department of Health having an organisation with a memory. But the quotes here, although they're a bit motherhood and apple pie, do stand. With hindsight, it is easy to see a disaster waiting to happen. The key is spotting one in advance. We've got some good examples of sector-specific guidance from professional bodies, and this is a good example in radiotherapy. Not necessarily because its contents are wonderful, that's for you to judge. The important thing is that this report was produced by the National Patient Safety Agency, the Health Protection Agency, the British Institute of Radiology, the physicists, the radiographers, the radiologists. Everybody contributed to this because they felt everyone needed to contribute to help generate that safety culture. And if you haven't got a copy of this and you're interested not only in radiotherapy but any medical radiation use, I suggest you have a look at it. Practically, at your hospital, at your institution, what can you do to promote a proper and safe culture? As I said before, you need to start at the top. If the management is not supportive and doesn't take this seriously, you will go nowhere. It has to be a key priority. Not purely safety is a key priority, but that the safety culture is a key priority. And safety has to become integral to clinical practice and the systems that you run. It's not something that you bolt on afterwards. As soon as you do that, it's an afterthought and it will get dropped. It has to be there from the beginning. Top down, bottom up. We've said management has to be there, but management has to provide an environment where every individual feels that they can contribute, and that they can have a say, and that they can help move things forward and challenge. And without that, again, we're not going to go very far. This isn't about writing lots of documents to satisfy some auditing group or some regulator and then the file gets put on the shelf. It has to be a living process. Safety and the safety culture has to be embedded in what we're doing. And my suggestion at the end, I think, is that in industry or in any commercial organisation, if an organisation wants to improve, it tends to follow a rule of three. It's no good parachuting in a new chief executive and expecting everything to change. You need at least three people who will go in together with a common goal, who can support each other and then permeate their ideas throughout an organisation. And I think we need this very much around safety culture in medicine, in our departments of radiology, nuclear medicine or radiotherapy. We need a radiographer or technician, a physicist and a medical member of staff whose role it is to be the supporters, the evangelists around safety culture. It's got to be part of their job because it's no good having one of them because it then becomes subject to professional exchanges and it becomes subject to individualism. It has to be a group of people who are working together on all the aspects that are important in the delivery of the service. We've come a long way from 1912 and the Titanic, when we didn't realise what the problem was, and we now do. We've got a lot to do, but at least we know the size of the problem or the approaches that we need to take, but we still have to be serious about this. This is something that we have to be committed to, otherwise we will fail and continue to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. Please stay on stage. May I ask the three other speakers to move here to the microphone to respond to questions. We have 10 more minutes to go and we are going to have a kind of discussion. Lawrence Lowe has some hearing problems. Therefore, if you want to ask a specific questions to him, he has a temporary hearing problems. If you want to ask a specific question to Lawrence Lowe, please make it in writing. That will be easier. Maybe I start with the following question. What we see is that innovation in technology, if we want to be practical, innovation in technology is good to improve quality of medicine. But it's much faster than quality and validation. And Michael Brada showed that to us very much. Then we have millions of questions around what you said. Then what should we do on practical grounds for the future? Can each of you give one answer? What should we do in the future in terms of global health perspective? What is a key decision? You have one answer, each of you, because we have only 10 minutes. Who starts?
It's always best to go first. I'm going to steal from Michael, actually. I think Michael made it very clear that lots of the things that we're doing that are coming at breakneck speed don't actually provide all the benefits that we think they do. And so the lack of time that we think we have for doing safety as part and parcel of evaluation and so on is probably there if we do it in a consistent way around the things that really matter, that will really make a difference. So apologies, Michael, but that's my view and I think I've stolen yours.
Well, I guess for medical imaging, technology is moving very quickly. The challenge really is for the users to appreciate the pros and cons and to use what we have wisely. And that is why referral guidelines are so important, because it's very difficult for people to stay up to date with the current change in thinking. And so a harmonized set of global guidelines would be very useful for both developed and developing nations, and in different settings, remote rural or in the urban area.
Well, I'm going to borrow something from Steve. I believe that it's a system that needs to be, and it's a system issue. And the system issue is that there needs to be a promotion of academic culture that allows for proper evaluation of medical equipment. So the same as exists for the introduction of drugs, that you don't allow drugs to be introduced unless they not only show safety, but that's the priority, but actually show efficacy. And you need to pump money into this, and you need to make it independent of industry. And then you need to require each new medical product, whatever it is in terms of radiation, to be tested and only be introduced into the clinical arena if it shows a benefit that's been a priori defined for its use.
Nearly everything has been said, and I underpin that. I would like to address two points. The one point is the academic culture. We are putting too much pressure on the young scientist to publish. And all these these fancy technologies are things you get quick results. This is a bad approach of culture. The second approach is to bring the industry to the science community and to the professionals. Like what I mentioned with the International Atomic Energy Agency, to bring them with the professional societies on board and to discuss with them and not to take over the drive they are just for commercial reasons doing.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting for our regulator. We have a lot of work. Questions from the floor? Yes, please speak loudly. Go to the microphone, we can't hear you. No, go to the microphone. You have a microphone down there. Yeah.
So,
much better.
The title of this session.
The title on the microphone. This session, yes, please.
Okay, the title of this session is Global Healthcare Perspectives. And we've heard an awful lot about high technology, and we've heard an awful lot about safety culture in probably healthcare level one countries. But what we haven't heard about, just a little bit, is the 27 member states of WHO who have no radiotherapy whatsoever. And I wonder what the panel, you know, how they consider we can implement safety culture and deliver modern uses of therapy in developing countries, as opposed to healthcare level one countries. Could we have some thoughts on that?
Please.
I mentioned in my short address that I'm sitting together with the AGARD meeting from the organized under the pact. And this is particularly what you are questioning. We have to sit there together with the companies and with the agency, with the WHO, and develop a comprehensive development plans. And with adapted technologies, and when discussing these very delicate issues with the developing countries, it turns out that the developing countries are jealous to have the same standard of high technology. And what I am promoting is the idea of a disease-adapted technology. You cannot treat T4 tumors with the same technology like T1 tumors. So we have to communicate with these developing countries, with industry and the professional organizations.
it seems to me that the key issue is not only those countries which don't have technology, is the fact that each institution may have a different technology in their hands. Okay, the major universities have the brand new technique, and some other small hospitals have not so much of these new techniques. And therefore, it is for each institution, with the equipment they have, to make the proper use of their technology. And there is, I see some danger when, for example, you see publications from very famous institutions in radiation therapy where many physicists work together to make very fancy new radiation therapy, and a small hospital, just like in France, the Hospital of Epinal, tries to do that, and they fail because they don't have the competence yet to do that. And that was okay. This major accident with 5,000 people involved. Some comments?
I think you're absolutely right. You need the infrastructure that goes with the technology. And we have to be honest about that. And if the infrastructure isn't there, then you have to think very seriously about whether the technology should be adopted. So I think the key thing is for the third world, for the developing world, for 1, 2, 3, and 4, because as we talked, some of us last week, there are plenty of places in the so-called developed and high-tech countries that don't have the infrastructure in certain regions, then essentially there has to be some honesty about what infrastructure is needed, and there has to be some global support from organisations such as WHO and IAEA to make sure that that's fully understood and these places are supported. But you can't separate out the technology from the associated infrastructure if we're going to take forward these new developments in a sensible and sustainable and safe way.
Okay, thank you. Michael?
Well, I have no personal experience in this, other than that I teach on an ESTRO course supported by IAEA in countries that don't have the high tech. And we started having a course that teaches the transition from low tech to high tech. And that is because in these countries, actually, everybody wants to have the high tech. Okay, so that's one take on it. The other is, you're asking a question that I think the agency and the WHO have been struggling with for the last 20 years. The technology is there. That is stripped down from the very high tech. It's available. There are people who can do it. So the barriers must be somewhere else. I think the high technology in terms of improvement of outcome is the likelihood of improvement is relatively small, so they don't need it. But what the pressures are that don't allow the simple technology to be introduced is obviously a political and economic issue that I don't understand well enough.
Okay. Lawrence, a final word on your side? No on justification? Nothing. Okay. It's time to close the session. We had a very interesting session. Thank you very much to all speakers. We introduced very well the subjects. Thank you.